From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Florida's governor says after healthcare workers have devoted so much to helping people survive during the pandemic, he doesn't think they should lose their jobs for refusing to be vaccinated.
Well, how is this going to help that problem? Are you going to fire all these nurses who have been treating COVID patients or been working all this time?
Also this week, a University of Miami study suggests some ways in-person school attendance can be made safer in the age of COVID.
Nobody knows exactly whether or not somebody you interact with is going to get COVID or not, but there's a certain probability based on the CDC guidelines.
We'll also get the latest on Governor DeSantis's plans to change the way public schools test students and explore the difference between legal and illegal corruption when it comes to public officials. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Governor Ron DeSantis is pushing back on employee vaccine mandates put in place recently by both the federal and local governments. DeSantis calls them illegal. He also says the mandates will make worker shortages in areas like healthcare worse. Regan McCarthy has more on that story.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is railing against the new mandate announced by President Joe Biden. It would, among other things, require businesses with 100 or more employees to ensure every worker is either vaccinated for COVID-19 or tested weekly for the coronavirus. It also requires full vaccination for healthcare workers at hospitals that receive Medicaid or Medicare funding. That's nearly every hospital. DeSantis calls the move illegal.
This is not constitutional, what he's doing. Everyone in his administration for 9 months said they don't have the ability to do this, that that shouldn't be mandated.
The governor is also pushing back on local mandates. He says vaccination requirements some local governments have put in place for their employees runs afoul of a new state law.
If a government agency in the state of Florida forces a vaccine as a condition to employment, that violates Florida law. And you will face a $5,000 fine for every single violation.
DeSantis says some counties could easily rack up millions of dollars in fines. Counties are pushing back on the governor's claims, saying the law doesn't prohibit them from requiring employees to get vaccinated. Vince Long is county administrator in Leon County, where employees must be vaccinated by October 1st or risk losing their jobs.
We believe that we are on strong legal authority as an employer to require employees to become vaccinated as a condition of employment. That's our position, and again, it is currently in effect.
One of DeSantis' arguments against the mandates is his concern about the impact on the workforce. He uses hospital workers as an example.
What have we been talking about for so long about the hospitals? It has never been a lack of beds, even though that's what they said at the beginning. It's you have very short staff sometimes, and it's very hard to get nurses. There's a shortage. They have contract nurses come in. There's all these different things. Every single hospital, that's like the number one thing they will say. Well, how is this going to help that problem? Are you going to fire all these nurses who have been treating COVID patients or been working all this time?
Justin Senior, CEO of the Safety Net Hospital Alliance of Florida, says that was a concern and was one reason some hospitals had not yet put their own mandates in place. But he says that worry is now reduced because nearly all hospitals have to follow the same rules.
It does take away the possibility that one of your ER nurses is going to go to another ER because they all of the emergency rooms, all the hospitals with emergency rooms, by and large, are going to take Medicare and Medicaid. But they could go to a private practice. They could go to another setting where there is no mandate.
Senior says another concern for hospitals has been timing. Some people experience a couple of days of illness following a COVID shot, and hospitals want to make sure their workers aren't all calling out sick at the same time coronavirus cases are spiking. But Senior says that should be easier to navigate now, too, because many workers have already been vaccinated.
There were a lot of different concerns back in July and in August that are sort of abated a little bit as the caseloads have started coming down, and abated a little bit as hospitals have put out incentives for their workers to become vaccinated in the absence of a mandate, things that have really increased the percentage of hospital workers who have who've gotten the vaccine.
Senior also points out it's not unusual for workers in a healthcare setting to be required to get certain vaccines. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Vaccinating teachers and cutting class sizes in half would go a long way toward curbing the spread of COVID-19 in schools. Those are the findings of a new study from the University of Miami. WLRN education reporter Jessica Bakeman recently spoke with the study's author, Daniel Messinger. He explains how his research in preschool classrooms offers more scientific evidence supporting vaccine requirements and physical distancing policies in schools. Messinger's research has been submitted for publication and is not yet peer-reviewed.
Before the pandemic, we were studying how children move around in classrooms and what they say, and the language they hear from their peers and from teachers. Children wear these cute little vests, and the vests have two things. So one is a little sensor that says where they are in the room, and the other is an audio recorder. How much you talk to your peers, that's associated with your language ability. We are less interested right now in what they're saying, but more interested in how much they're saying and kind of the complexity of their speech.
So when COVID-19 hit, I guess you realized this data that you had been collecting could be used for a totally different scientific purpose.
It occurred to us that we knew where all the kids had been in the classroom for all these observations. So I guess that's the important part about the position sensors. And kids actually wear two in the vest, so there are two little pockets on either side. So that means we know which way they're facing. And that's quite important from the perspective of COVID. So what we did is we simulated the spread of COVID given the actual observations of where children were and how they had interacted with one another in these classrooms.
So you could look back at data that you had collected previously showing how students move around and who they talk to and how long they talk to each other and how often and all that stuff. And then you could say, okay, if student A had COVID, how likely is it that they would have given it to other students? And if so, how many? That sort of thing.
That's exactly what we did. We then repeated it 60 times for that same child A, because nobody knows exactly whether or not somebody you interact with is going to get COVID or not, but there's a certain probability based on the CDC guidelines. So we simulated it for student A 60 times, and then we simulated it for every other student and teacher in the classroom.
And what did you find?
We found that the density of children and teachers in the classroom, that was the key factor in rates of infection. So if there are fewer individuals in a given space, it's safer.
Your results assume no one is wearing masks. Is that right? Since you collected the data before teachers and students were wearing masks to school.
That's correct. We did not simulate mask wearing. So mask wearing would reduce the infection rate. We also did our simulations before the dominance or the predominance of the Delta variant. So that would increase the infection rate.
Do you plan to do it again with information related to the Delta variant?
Yep. We are currently working on simulating spread with the Delta variant and spread when children and teachers are wearing masks.
One of the other things you looked at in your simulation was whether the adults in the room were vaccinated or not. So can you tell me what the results were along those lines?
If it's a half-size class and the teachers are vaccinated, then in more than half the cases, the first COVID infection occurs. And remember, that's what we start with, but there never is a second infection. When teachers were vaccinated, we assumed that there was an 85% probability of vaccine effectiveness. I think what this study reminds us is that proximity matters and density matters. So we did our observations in preschool. So these are little kids. So when little kids eat snacks and lunch, it might be good to make sure they're as separate from one another as possible. Likewise, preschoolers often take naps. They typically take naps without their masks on. So the larger the space available when they take their naps, the more separate they can be and the better off they are.
That was WLRN education reporter Jessica Bakeman talking with University of Miami researcher Daniel Messinger. Still to come on Capitol Report, years ago, Florida was where the school testing boom got started. Now it may also be where that boom ends.
We literally are eliminating a test, and we're not replacing it with something. We're actually just going to use what we're already doing.
A public corruption scandal in Florida's capital city leads to a larger discussion of what should and shouldn't be considered ethical behavior by government officials.
And that's why it's so important for the city government to look at things like these lobby reform proposals that the ethics board has put forward.
Florida's manatee population has dropped by 10% as the sea cows are starving.
Rather than like keeping your foot on the gas and pushing toward recovery, pushing toward those targets, pushing toward habitat restoration, it was like pumping the brakes.
And an elementary school helps reinforce positive self-image for its female students by helping them learn they are much more than just the way their hair looks. How Florida assesses K-12 students' academic progress may be changing. Governor Ron DeSantis wants to get rid of most of the state's standardized tests, called Florida Standards Assessments, or FSA. Robbie Gaffney reports the state instead would rely on progress monitoring.
Ending FSA will be one of the governor's priorities for the 2022 legislative session. He says the tests are outdated. The exams are given at the end of the year. Results often come back after school is out, rendering the results mostly moot. The state saw a decrease in student math and reading scores during the pandemic, and the lag time in receiving test results only sped up the state's decision to get rid of the FSAs, says State Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran.
One of the silver linings of COVID was when we shut down the schools and we got rid of the FSA for that the remaining of school year, because that's what we did, what we noticed by looking at the progress monitoring, something that's done in every single school district, we looked at the progress monitoring data because that's what we still had. And what we noticed was, as the governor said, that the FSA is kind of antiquated.
By contrast, says DeSantis, progress monitoring can be done 3 times a year.
It gives the ability to have timely data during the school year so you can make the necessary corrections.
The Florida Education Association, the state's largest teachers union, has long pushed to drop standardized testing. And the governor's announcement is a win, says union president Andrew Spahr.
We literally are eliminating a test, and we're not replacing it with something. We're actually just going to use what we're already doing.
Spahr says progress monitoring allows educators to focus on student growth, and his group wants to make sure that's what the state focuses on, too.
And that's why we're going to have dialogue with the Department of Education, the Commissioner of Education, and lawmakers to make sure, as we look at how progress monitoring is used as part of the accountability system, that it's done so in the best possible of ways.
Still, the win comes with a catch. Education Commissioner Corcoran says Florida would have the exact same accountability system it has now when it drops FSA, meaning there will still be school and district grades, teacher evaluations tied to student progress, and the system that's in place for addressing failing and low-performing schools. Spahr says that leaves a lot of questions to be answered.
So realistically, it's going to be, how are we going to measure students at the end of the year and convert that into a measurement in which we grade schools, talk about student promotion, and talk about teacher evaluation.
For now, teachers are hoping to get a seat at the legislative table when discussions begin on how a new assessment system will work. I'm Robbie Gaffney.
Public corruption, though rare, has been making Florida headlines lately. A state legislative ghost candidate in South Florida recently pleaded guilty to criminal charges after accepting money to put his name on the ballot without seriously running for office. In Tallahassee, meanwhile, former City Commissioner Scott Maddox and his girlfriend, the former head of the city's Downtown Improvement Authority, Paige Carter-Smith, were recently sentenced to 5 years and 2 years in federal prison, respectively, for orchestrating a bribery scheme. Their associate, J.T. Burnett, was recently convicted after a week-long trial. Integrity Florida's Ben Wilcox studies public corruption at state and local levels. Valerie Crowder sat down with him to get his take on the corruption scandal in Tallahassee.
In your view, what went wrong to allow this to take place, this illegal corruption with Scott Maddox?
Well, you know, he purposely constructed this whole scheme of how he was going to benefit personally and privately from his government service. He set up a lobbying organization, governance, that he would refer business to, and people would have to pay Paige Carter Smith to quote-unquote lobby. And I point out she never registered as a lobbyist with the city. But, you know, it was a whole scheme, it was a complex scheme. But it was basic pay-to-play. And my fear is that there are people still involved with city government, either actually in city government or these contractors that work on the outside, they are still involved with city government. And in some cases, I don't know if they just turned a blind eye to what was going on with Scott Maddox or if they actually enabled him to do what he was doing. That's the root of this, what I talk about as being systemic corruption, and that's what we need to get to.
Do you think that there is more corruption going on in local government that people are not aware of?
Yeah. Well, we make a distinction between illegal corruption and legal corruption. And I think we've probably dealt with the illegal corruption, but I think there's still systemic legal corruption in Tallahassee City government. It's just become ingrained into the way we do business. And that's why it's so important for the city government to look at things like these lobby reform proposals that the Ethics Board has put forward. The people of Tallahassee need to see a response from city government. It's not just, oh, well, you know, nothing to see here. Let's all look away and get back to business as usual. You know, that's not going to cut it. You know, the people of Tallahassee need to see a response from their government.
Can you give me some examples of legal corruption, what that looks like?
Well, you can see it from the Burnett trial. I mean, there were text messages from Scott Maddox talking about how he was helping select the new city manager. And he bragged, claimed responsibility that he put the city manager in that job, you know, promoted him from within. So it was basically keeping up business as usual in the city of Tallahassee. But that's one example. And it gets to the way these no-bid contracts are approved, the way these hotel projects get approved, controversial developments like the Wilani development, you know, and people are so frustrated because they just wanted the process to be transparent and to be done deliberately, and it just felt like it was rushed, pushed through.
After a public corruption trial like this, people might wonder if they can trust their local government. What would you say to them?
There's understandably, you know, a lot of cynicism among the public right now after watching this whole thing play out and seeing what was, you know, actually, you know, seeing the crime that was committed against the people of Tallahassee. And one of the byproducts of all that cynicism is that people just give up. They don't, you know, they don't want to interact with government. They don't want to go to city commission meetings and speak, you know, about things they either agree or disagree with. I would just say I understand that the public is cynical. They should be, but they should also try to rise above that cynicism and continue to work to make Tallahassee a great place to live.
That was Capitol reporter Valerie Crowder speaking with Integrity Florida's Ben Wilcox. You may have heard about how manatees in Florida are dying at an unprecedented rate. So far this year, at least 942 manatees have died, a loss representing 10% of the animal's population in the state. WMFE's Amy Green reports the setback comes 4 years after the manatee was declared on its way to recovery and downlisted from endangered to threatened.
The manatee was too weak to swim.
You are looking at the body shutting down. You're looking at the body eating its own fat reserves. You're looking at the body doing a lot of things to try to save the core. And when that goes on, would that be discomfort? Absolutely. Would that be painful? More than likely.
John Peterson eyed the manatee as she lay still in a medical pool at a SeaWorld rehabilitation center, only lifting her whiskered snout every so often to breathe. Her body was slender, hardly that of the chunky manatee she should have been, a relative of elephants.
Right now, every calorie I'm putting in is trying to care for the body's decay that's going on. It's trying to take care of the infections that are raging. So none of those calories yet are going to put weight on. They're literally going to try to save her body.
The manatee was near death from starvation. Peterson, who helped supervise her care, called the manatee number 37 because she was the 37th manatee to be rescued this year from Florida waters. She's one of the lucky ones. Of the staggering number of deaths this year in Florida, many are related to the kind of starvation number 37 suffered from. More than half of the deaths are in the Indian River Lagoon, a biologically diverse East Coast estuary where ongoing water quality problems have led to a widespread loss of seagrass, the manatee's preferred food. Environmental groups say on the East Coast, some 20% of the manatee population has been wiped out. Two Florida congressional leaders, Democrat Darren Soto of Kissimmee and Republican Vern Buchanan of Sarasota, have filed legislation aimed at restoring the manatee's endangered status. Pat Rose of the Save the Manatee Club says the downlisting not only was premature, but neglected scientifically documented warning signs at the time that manatees were in trouble, leaving the animals vulnerable for the latest in a series of mortality events.
If you don't believe it's a serious issue and it's going to be a short-term problem, you're not going to put the scientific effort into it or the political effort or the management practices into place to prevent those declines in the future.
Among the most important habitats in the world for manatees is the Indian River Lagoon. The estuary's warm, brackish waters and historically lush seagrass provide a haven, especially during the winter, for the animals, which are stressed in cold water.
The small, you know, piece of the IRL that we're seeing actually looks pretty good compared to how we've seen in the past.
Bill Greer at the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission peered into the tea-colored water from a grassy shore in Melbourne Beach. For several years, ongoing nutrient pollution associated with fertilizers and septic tanks, for instance, have triggered harmful algae blooms that can cloud the lagoon's historically crystal water, preventing sunlight from reaching the seagrass undulating beneath the surface. In some parts of the lagoon, nearly all of the seagrass is gone. For manatees, the paucity means that when a cold snap occurs, they face a crucial choice, whether to stay and potentially starve or forage elsewhere and freeze. In January 2021, it was clear something was wrong again in the Indian River Lagoon. Greer is part of a three-person team rescuing dead and ailing manatees in the lagoon. And after a series of cold snaps, the team members began receiving almost daily calls about dead manatees.
It's fairly physical work, just handling the carcasses and manipulating them, doing the exams.
Between December 2020 and May 2021, there were 677 dead manatees reported on Florida's East Coast, the highest number ever recorded in the state during a six-month period. Greer's team reached out to other agencies for help.
It also got to a point where we were trying to make sure we were getting enough time, you know, to kind of recuperate.
The massive manatee die-off comes just 4 years after the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced it would downlist the animal. The agency said it was because gains in the animal's population and habitat meant its status no longer fit the definition of endangered. Among the manatees rescued this year were 13 orphan calves. At least two ended up at the SeaWorld Rehabilitation Center in Orlando, in a tank not far from number 37's. The baby manatees looked plump as they slurped hungrily from bottles, although they faced a long recovery. They were called number 26 and number 31. Both were perhaps days old when they were rescued, one with its umbilical cord still attached. Here's John Peterson of SeaWorld.
Unfortunately, their mothers are either mortalities or somehow came separated from them.
What concerns Peterson is that starvation involves a much longer recovery than other threats like red tide, which takes 2 to 3 weeks to treat. For starvation, the recovery is 6 to 8 months, and he worries about running out of space should another die-off occur. He's working with other partner organizations to move more healthy manatees elsewhere, to free up SeaWorld's medical pools for more fragile animals, like number 37. Amy Green in Orlando.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Tallahassee's Sable Palm Elementary School is hosting Curls for Queens tomorrow. The hair care and styling event for black and brown girls is an outgrowth of the school's focus on community needs. Chelsea Long reports last year the school partnered with a local technical college to offer haircuts for boys, and this year the focus is on boosting the esteem of young black girls.
Sable Palm offers food and healthcare services to its students and their families. But Principal Anisha Robinson says there was something else missing, the ability to access quality, affordable hair care. It's a need, Robinson says, was brought to her attention by a coworker.
But a couple of the girls she was running into contact with needed hair services. So that just kind of sparked that idea. She was like, I want to do something for the girls, and now this was our opportunity to do something for them. So that's just kind of how Curls for Queens kind of started.
The she Robinson is talking about is Michaela Fett, the school's community wellness coordinator. Black hair has been an historically fraught issue, one that's shrouded in stigma and in stereotypes. Shatima Jones, a sociology professor at New York University, says black hair has always been judged and policed by outsiders.
I don't necessarily want to use the word burden, but tasked, right, with this extra labor of having to think about our hair in ways that white and non-black women, other non-black women don't have to do. Mm-hmm. White women are not sitting around thinking, oh, how should I wear my hair so that I look professional and get this job? They don't do that. We should just get to wear our hair however we want to, however we feel. That's just not the society that we live in.
And those attitudes, they trickle down to children. The criticism on hair has hit black girls hardest, says Jones.
Who do kids see on television? It starts from those representations. Who's beautiful, right? Who gets the guy in the end? Because if who has the long flowy hair? That, not even that you have hair, but it's supposed to be long, straight. Like, we're supposed to be thin, not... Like, so this is what representation on television is telling us. This is what, do you know what I mean?
Principal Robinson knows that well, and she says it shouldn't have to be that way.
But your hair makes you feel good, you know, and your hair makes you happy, and it also gives you a chance to kind of express the kind of person you are. And if you want to switch it up, if we want to do braids one day, if I want to do a bun, if I want to do puffs, you know, and it is an important part of who we are, but it also isn't. It isn't who we are.
Still, it is the current reality. And that's why Robinson and her team at Sable Palm feel so strongly about Curls for Queens.
I think the India RE song, I'm Not My Hair, is a perfect, perfect example. It could be the theme for this program. But the truth and the reality is, you're not your hair, but your hair makes you feel good.
Community organizers and school staff hope the event will empower students, boost their self-esteem, and in turn, promote academic success. I'm Chelsea Long.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Valerie Crowder, Robbie Gaffney, Gina Jordan, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to Jessica Bakeman, Amy Green, and Chelsea Long. Technical assistance for Capital Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.